Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today, I'm really excited. I'm sitting down and chatting to Carl. Carl is a paramedic, but we are talking about something a little bit different today. We are talking about not so much the common idea that all you have to do as a paramedic is work on road. And Carl has reached out to me recently and wanted to talk about sort of his approach to the career of paramedicine and where it's taken him. And he wanted to share that with you guys to be able to start thinking about some alternative options that you may have and sort of get you excited about what might be out there for you. So thanks for jumping on, Carl. Do you want to introduce yourself about, you know, who you are, what you do, and, you know, your journey with paramedicine?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Alex. So I'm Carl. I'm a paramedic. I graduated probably about nearly 2 years ago. And when I graduated, I had the notion that I need to go on the front line and do my NQP and complete that. You know, after doing all the 3 years at uni, getting my bachelor's degree, it was the continuous, consistent, you go do your NQP, you go do your NQP. And I'd say probably the second year of the paramedic degree, before COVID, because that's when COVID hit, was halfway through my second year. I wasn't really feeling the front line very much. I don't know if it was just a bad spell of jobs that I was getting or if it was because the stress at university. I couldn't say, to be honest with you, exactly what it was, but I just wasn't feeling the hunger for it like I did in first year and getting into the paramedic degree in the first place. As time went on and COVID hit, it got a lot worse in terms of how I was feeling and not being on the front line. We got taken off for a certain amount of time due to insurance purposes, and you got to respect that. But then they started sending us to other places within our placements where we got paid, which was quite good because that was the only way we could do it at that time with the beginning of the COVID. I went to Walsall Manor, went to a cardiac critical care unit. That was a good experience. Some of us got to go to GP surgeries. I think that's more open now as well. I'm not sure, but I think universities are adopting that more because they've changed from the 2 year degree to the 3 year degree. And part of that is primary care elements. So I would imagine as part of that, they probably do adopt a GP surgery or primary care placement. And also, as the COVID pandemic happened and started, I did help out a little bit in London, which I was very fortunate to do, to be honest. And when I did that, I kind of saw things from a different perspective within the healthcare system. I saw how when I was in London, and this was like April, May time, when the pandemic first hit, so no one knew what they were doing. Everyone was trying to just go with the flow and do their best with what they had to work with. And, you know, fair play to all the healthcare professionals out there and the essential workers. You know, they all did what they could with what they had to work with. And we all got bits of information brought through, sieved through from the government. And even that made things more difficult at times because sometimes it was mixed messages or it wasn't clear. But moving forward from that, so went to London and I was part of the response retrieval team and the ambulance team there from the Royal Papworth Hospital, ICU. And we would take patients from other hospitals around London. And they would go to the Royal Papworth. That was the base for people on ECMO and people that are really, really bad with COVID. So when that happened, I kind of saw the healthcare system, how it was struggling, not just because of the pandemic, but the staff, the teams. You know, nurses were being not ignored, but they weren't really being treated as equals in that respect. Doctors were so stressed and they couldn't even make decisions like you think they would. You know, we all turn to doctors, don't we? Where we want a major decision to be made, because that's the stigma of it. They get paid the most, they do the most training, they make the decisions. But, you know, it's the doctors are only as good as the people around them, especially in that type of environment, in a ward and an ICU. Same with the nurses and the paramedics. Now, I wasn't a paramedic at that point, but I was part of the ambulance at that point. But there were paramedics there, air ambulances and whatnot, who also joined in and helped out. So when I found out how that was, I noticed the communication barriers, and I noticed that we were following an old healthcare model. So when I was at uni, the first year, I was learning about the different models. And one of the models that I was taught about was the holistic model. I don't know if you're familiar with that wording. Sometimes they call it the patient-centered care model or whatnot. It was adopted from mental health. So it's look at the person as a whole. But what they were doing at the Royal Papworth and at the other hospitals was looking at the disease, the medical model, an outdated model. And when they did that, it was kind of like, treat the disease. Don't look at the patient or what the patient has, the comorbidities. Don't look at what they need. Just treat the disease. And it's like, but like, this person's diabetic, so they need insulin. This person is COPD, so you've got to watch not to overoxygenate them, especially the type 2 respiratory failure, and so on and so forth. So it wasn't really been looked at as much as you'd think. Now, I understand the stress, the shock, the whole situation can get the better of all of us. And it did. It really did. But when I got back, I had to process this, and reflection was key in that situation, Alex, because I had to try and make sense of what I'd saw, because I got taught things at uni, had experience in the ambulance before uni, and then I saw that, and it really threw me off. It really caused disdain, confusion. I couldn't even figure out what was going on, to be honest. It was a blur. So once I reflected, and I recommend that everyone reflects, especially on things that are difficult for them, because it does help. Even if you do it in your own way, if you feel like, oh, I'm not going to do the Gibbs model or the other model, reflect, just write something down. Write something down and you read it back to yourself, and it can make a lot more sense the second time around. So after that, I reflected, and then it made a bit more sense. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to write something about this. So I did. Never thought I'd get it published. Never thought I'd do anything like that. I'm a student at the end of the day, second year. So why would I get published? That wasn't the intention. However, I thought, you know what, I'll approach a couple of journals and see what they say. I've got nothing to lose. I did. And one agreed to publish it. So they published it. And then from there, I was able to get another journal from America, Washington, who contacted me, and because they read it, because it all goes online and Google Scholar and whatnot. And they asked me to peer review their journals. So that's when they get new manuscripts from doctors and researchers. And you've got to peer review to make sure they've done it correctly and improve scientific rigor and whatnot. So I did that. And I'm not going to lie, my first couple were not very good. But that's important, because when you're a healthcare professional or even healthcare itself, it's about taking responsibility for what you see is that you need to work on. And that's a big part of your registration as well. You need to take responsibility for your registration and where you feel that you need to improve. So I knew that my peer reviewing was not the best. I was very appreciative of the journal to let me do another, because I did learn from it. However, I thought, I need to do something better than this. They need more from me. And I know I can give more. I just need to understand how to give more. So I don't know if you've heard of it. I don't think it's around anymore. But have you ever heard of Publons Academy?
No, I haven't, no.
That's fair. I didn't either until I searched it up. So Publons Academy is basically an academy for people that review and are into research and whatnot. And they did a course. It was free. It was online. And it was like, I think it was like 9 modules. Don't quote me on that. And these 9 modules was basically to learn how to peer review in a systematic way, step by step. And then you had to peer review 2 articles of your choosing, and then someone else, a tutor, would then review your review, peer review your review, if you will. And I got to do that, and I learned a system of how to do it, and then I adopted it into my own system. And now I've probably peer reviewed about 9 different articles over the space of 3 years. So I'm much more confident now, but only with that system. If you take that system away from me, I kind of go all over the place. So I do have a system, and it does work well, but only certain types of reviews. I'm more quantitative statistics. I can do those reviews a lot better than qualitative. I still can't understand qualitative very well. I'll put my hand up to that. So after I did that, then if you take all that situation that happened before I qualified, then I went back to uni. I was still, you know, kept my hand in the reviewing and in the journal. They asked me to be a project editorial assistant and help them with projects of the journal. So I did that. Review, reformat policies, all that jazz. Market the journal. And then as time went on after that, and this was all voluntary, I wasn't getting paid for this. It was just putting myself out there and learning. And it's very good to do that. It's good to put yourself out a little bit, even places of the unknown, and just take that step forward and learn more about what it is that they do and why they do it. You know, when I'm sure I could speak to for most people here, but in the second year of the degree, when you do your first review, you do a paper, don't you? You look at a paper and mine was on blue lights and, you know, are they dangerous? And I had to peer review it as part of my evidence-based practice module. And I absolutely hated it, if I'm honest, because I didn't understand any of it. But after going to the journal and after getting that help and taking the steps myself to learn the way that I know how I do, and then adapting what I'd learned into the way that I know I can do that, it makes a lot more sense now and it works a lot better. So I urge people to do that. Don't be afraid to take those steps. Don't be afraid to focus on your strengths and your weaknesses, but utilize your strengths in the things that you don't understand. So after that, then I qualified. And at that point, I didn't really want to go on the front line. I didn't want to do it. I loved the primary care aspect, the OSCEs, learning those different things. That really interested me. Loved the research part of it. But the front line, no, I didn't really enjoy it at all. And maybe COVID has something to do with that. I had doubts before of how I was feeling. There was mixed feelings there, but COVID should definitely didn't help. So I didn't want to do my NQP, but everyone was saying, you've got to do your NQP. You've got to do your NQP. You can't do anything until you do your NQP. The jobs that you go for, you've got to have 2 years experience, 3 years experience, 5 years experience before you do those jobs. And that's got to be within a trust, within the front line. Not that they call it the front line, but clinical. So when it got to it, I thought, oh, I'm gonna have to do it, aren't I? I don't want to, but I'm gonna have to. So I did try and do it. Unfortunately, I did it not with the trust. I tried to get in the trust. They didn't accept me in the trust, but I did apply for a job that was involved in research as well. It wasn't like a NQP paramedic job. I tried to see if I could do my NQP while I was doing the research side of it. So that's probably why I didn't get in. Maybe I should have just gone for NQP and done it that way. But you got to try these things, haven't you? If you don't try, you don't get, do
Exactly.
you? So I went for a private company, and the private company is a great company. Unfortunately, NQPs was very new there, and they were not able to facilitate when NQPs needed extra support, especially because of COVID. Because I don't know if anyone here has been involved within the COVID year, because I know it was, let's say 2 years ago. But we didn't have to complete all our hours at the end. We had to get to as most hours as we could. As long as we got signed off, we passed. I don't agree with that fully, but I understand why. Because the amount of times I went through like four mentors in my final year, four mentors. So that was inconsistent at the start, really. And then after that, people were off sick. If you had COVID, you're off for so many days and you got to test negative for so many days. And it just impacted everyone's placements. So that's why they allowed that. The HCPC allowed that. But it didn't help when you got out away from the mentors. It kind of worked against us. And I know I needed that extra support, and I didn't get that extra support that I needed. And maybe I could have communicated that more. Maybe I could have worked more with that company and tried to find a way around it. It's possible. But they were unable in the end to facilitate that. So I thought to myself, I thought, instead of trying to do something I feel I have to do, why don't I try and do something that I want to do, something I feel I can do? So there was a job that came for resuscitation trainer as part of the trust. And I thought, well, I've taught first aid before. I taught first aid in 2014 for a year. I taught private ambulance companies. I taught staff there, first aid and emergency response and extraction and whatnot. Extrication, rather, sorry, I'm thinking of the dentist. And also, I helped out at uni as well, teaching in space, which is a place for BCU. I think you know what space is, where the skill labs and skill stations, and you're allowed to borrow them and utilize them to prepare for your OSCEs. And apart on quiz days, I made my own quizzes. I do love a good quiz. So, who doesn't? So, it's one of those things where I did that and I thought, well, that's experience. Maybe I wasn't a practitioner at that time. Maybe I wasn't a paramedic, but I still have those skills and they're transferable. So I applied. And what got me the job wasn't just that. What I found out was because I did that work for the journal, reformatting and revising policies, because I marketed the journal, because I reviewed and peer reviewed for the journal and did projects for the journal, part of my role in training as part of the resuscitation team is to audit, review, reformat policies, and revise certain things and do reports. So it all came together and it was all stuff I did before I became a paramedic. Then there's the mindset, because you might have skills, but you also need to have the right mindset for the role as well. And because of what I've been through, when it comes to, I wouldn't say a lack of support as such, it's just not getting the support I needed at that time. And that showed me that I need to be able to give that support to others, because I never got that at that time. So I do my best to try and support others. And that's what I like to do, what I do, because I can support others within that field. And because I'm part of the community trust, you look at an acute trust, Alex, and it's like they get like, what, 7 cardiac arrests a week in the acute hospital, maybe more. In the community, we get about 13 a month, 13 a year. So it's not much exposure, but it's being understanding towards that. And it's the same as when you're out on the front line. If you don't get much exposure to a certain skill that you've learned, certain knowledge that you've learned, and you don't use it, you're going to lose it. So to a certain, So to a certain point, you've got to be responsible for your own learning, your own CPD, continuous professional development. But at the same time, your workplace needs to be supportive of you as well. Give you chances to do that, to explore that. Allow you to, if you make certain, not mistakes as such, but I find that these days, if someone makes a mistake or an error or says something wrong, they get criticized way too easily. And I think that's not really the camaraderie and team ethic that healthcare workers should adopt. I think it's more that you should support one another and be there for each other. So someone doesn't understand a certain thing that they may have done twice. Okay, fine. Why is that? Let's try and find out what the problem is. Let's not criticize. Let's try and see if we can help that person. Because if we can help them, it helps us as well, because we're a team. So that's why I like to teach. And that's why I try and adopt that. And when it comes to doctors and nurses, after what I saw in London, I try and explain to them to work together as well. Some doctors are brilliant with nurses. Like they treat them as equals, they respect them. But the general consensus of that, from what I found out, is if a nurse speaks up, because they're afraid to speak up at the best of times, if a nurse speaks up and they're correct, and the doctor either misses something or agrees with the nurse, then the doctor, that nurse has earned that doctor's respect. And from there on in, the doctor will listen to that nurse. But if the nurse is wrong, that doctor doesn't even consider what that nurse says. And that's not right. We can't be right all the time. But if someone's got a concern, they should still raise it. Whether they're right or wrong, we still raise concerns. And we shouldn't fear if we are right or wrong. These things should be validated and investigated and assessed to see, okay, what is your concern? Why are you concerned? What can we do to help with that?
I think you bring up some really great points, and I think to unpack, particularly like you said, with your journey of going through university, going on placements, COVID having such a significant impact on your perspective and outlook on what first responding looks like and the pre-hospital environment and the healthcare in general. It's fascinating that you brought up you said a phrase of having transferable skills. And I think that's such an important element of healthcare in general, but particularly things like paramedicine or nursing or medicine, whatever you're doing, but particularly paramedicine, because we're taught how to be problem solvers, how to work well under pressure, teamwork, lead, all of these skills that adaptable, literally, the list goes on, but you can adapt and all of those skills and put them into anything, really. And like you said, you've taken a different path that was into research and teaching and finding a passion that may not have necessarily been on an ambulance working on the front line, but being able to utilize the things that you saw during your journey and thinking, actually, I really wanted to have a positive impact on that for the future. I think it's noble. It's quite interesting to see and for you to have the actual courage to do that and go against the grain and to do something a bit different is really fascinating. And I mean, most of our listeners are from Australia, so the UK degree is a bit different. And the UK have, for paramedics, a lot of different aspects of working. But for the UK, the national thing at the moment for all our Aussie listeners is you have to have 2 years where you're considered a newly qualified paramedic.
Yeah.
You have to complete that before you're considered to be qualified. And then from there, once you have that 2 years under your belt, you can go and work in multiple different things, primary healthcare, in hospitals, in A&Es and cardiology wards, and working for, GPs, doing all different
prison
things.
Prison paramedic, cruise ship paramedics, hospice paramedics.
Literally everything.
Aeromeds, repatriation.
Yeah.
Disability assessors. The list goes on.
Literally. And it's very different to what Australia have at the moment. And I'm sure Australia will get there one day in terms of what pathways you can go into with paramedicine. But quite a few of the things you bring up there in regards to going against the grain, I've come across a lot of people like that during my time of particularly doing this podcast, because before this I was the same as you, like starting off uni just thinking, oh, frontline paramedic, it's all you can do. And I really love how you brought up, you've got to take on the opportunities, you've got to find the opportunities, you've got to reflect and learn from things so that you can then actually figure out what you want to do and take on the opportunities, because you don't know what opportunities are out there unless you start taking them. And then that, you know, the road will just go on. Like this podcast, literally, I had no idea about the UK. I had no idea about all the things you can do here. I had no idea about America, research, anything, expedition medicine, humanitarian medicine. There's so many things.
That's true. That's a good one.
Like you said, you know, just having that courage to just go against the grain, really, and give things a shot, because you might not have that much to lose anyway. And so, I just find that really fascinating, and that's what I love about it. And sorry to cut you off about going into what you do now with going into teaching, particularly like hospital staff and things like that. I think that's really fascinating as well. And like you said, reflection plays such a huge role in what you do and how you learn. And learning never ceases after uni. If anything, you have to do more of it. But it's more focused and targeted. So what are you finding at the moment now? So you're teaching. You're doing lots of things. You told me off air what you're doing, and I swear the list is so long.
I could have wrote it down beforehand, really.
I don't get how you have time to do it all, to be fair.
Time management is very important, but you have to make sacrifices as well, and that's noticeable, social life and stuff like that. I don't get much time off. But I'm trying to build, and I have an interest in this, so I'm trying to build on that. But it is important to make time for family and friends and your life as well, what your hobbies are. You can't, don't put that to one side to the point where you don't do anything like that, because that's what we do this for. We don't live to work. We work to live. Yeah, I'm not sure how it works in Australia as such, but as you said, they're getting there and they're doing their own thing. But it's the same thing there as well in some respects. If someone wants to do, I don't know if it's a diploma or if it's a bachelor's degree or whatever it is in the education over there, it works the same. If you've got transferable skills and you've done things before, or you're interested in doing things, volunteer. If you want to do something in research, there's so many journals out there that will say, okay, do you want to become a reviewer? Do this. And then if you can learn, you've got lots of YouTube videos. You can self-teach, self-taught. It does help to a point. If you want feedback, majority of them will help when you do a review and you put it in, because they get 6 people to review an article. So they only need to take 2 of them. They don't need to take all of them. So if you're one of the 6, they've still got 5 more. So it's not like if you do it and you do it wrong, that's it, it's over. If you've got a journal that's quite understanding and they can see you're interested, then that can help out a lot. When it comes to self-teaching as well, there's lots of things out there now that we have access to that we didn't before. Publons Academy, for example, it has changed. I can't remember what it's called now. It's probably still Publons, but I'm sure it's something else. But that's another thing as well. That was one of the best things that I ever did. It took a long time.
And that's fantastic. I mean, obviously, like you said, you're doing quite a lot of things at the moment. What other aspects of your paramedic transferable skills are you using at the moment? Like, you do your teaching for your hospital staff and for the trust, and then Obviously, your research paper and everything like that. What else are you doing?
Yeah, it's true. So yeah, so with the research, it's not just the peer review. I also publish papers as well. After I published the first one, it was kind of a rolling thing. I published another one, and then someone asked me about. Then a journal came to me and asked me to publish a paper for them. It wasn't the other way around. So I thought, okay, I'll do that. I find them more difficult though. When someone asks me to write something, I'd rather write something I've got an interest in. And I'm not saying I don't have an interest in what they ask, but it's just a bit more difficult because I've got to learn about the subject quite a lot. And if I've already got an interest in something, I'm already started learning about it and trying to build an understanding of it. But if it's something I'm not 100% on, then it is a bit more difficult. And I find that the more I write, I tend to delete quite a lot of it and start over. Because the more I get into it, the more I learn about it. But I've published 8 papers altogether now. The recent paper I published was... So I teach internationally as well. So I teach people in Australia, Germany, Canada, Nigeria, whoever can get CPD and CME, if anyone's ever interested in those sort of things to try and maintain their education and their clinical skills to a point, like pediatric resuscitation, trauma. These are all important things, and they don't cost very much for the platform that I use. So I know there are requirements in certain countries on what you need to maintain your clinical skills. I don't know what it is in Australia or America, but I know that there are certain things. I know for us, we have the HCPC, and with them, they tend to encourage us to do what we do. I know some news came out with that as well, which I'm not sure if you're aware of, but because I'm set to renew my registration in a couple of months. Yes. So they want to do 2 days of education now somewhere or something. But yeah, I don't know what that's all about. But it's good. It's good to have education. And it's good that once I get an understanding of what that is, I'm sure I'll be able to do that effectively. You know, but it's the same with other countries as well. They need to make sure that they're up to date and are able to maintain their education. Education is so important. And like you said, you know, you've got to learn and you've got to try and continue that learning and don't be afraid to take those leaps. And when it comes down to it, so I try and help people do that. I try and help by providing a course, whether it's on resuscitation, deteriorating patient, whether it's on airway management. I'll do what I can, which is part of their CME, CPD, to maintain those skills and knowledge. I'll update them. And things change as well, so it's good to have updates on that. So I do that, but when I was doing it, someone approached me from Nigeria, and they said, I can't afford this course. I really want to take it. You know, I've passed my diploma. I'm sure it was a diploma there, if I'm not mistaken, paramedic diploma from a school. And I really want to take your course. And it was airway management. And I said, oh, really? It's only like $10 because it's an American company that I do it through. And they said, but $10, if you convert it from our money to your money or that money to our money, that's a quarter of our wages. I'm like, what? So I wasn't aware of this, and I thought, is it? So I looked at the conversion rate, and I thought, she's right, it's a lot of money. So I thought, it can't just be people from Nigeria that's having this problem. Who else is having this problem? So I looked at 122 different countries, 102 currencies, and I looked at the basic wage of each healthcare worker from the EMS in each country. Trust me, it was very hard to do that. Took a lot of time. Anyway, when I did it, I found 18 countries that would struggle, who are low to middle income countries, that would struggle to provide continuous medical education or maintain their continuous professional development. So when I saw them, I approached organizations. One organization who I do the peer review journaling with, they're on the same page already, and they want me to start teaching in Nigeria and Africa and whatnot, but they want me to start off with the public first. They think that the public lack that awareness. Like in, I don't know what it's like in Australia, Alex, but in the UK, as you've probably seen, there's a lot of awareness around. You know, you've got the ambulances that have the sepsis tool, you've got adverts on TV, even actors and famous people try and go across. You've got TV programs, TV shows, all education at the end of the day. Do they teach CPR in schools in Australia?
I think so. I think, yeah, I think they do. They must do, from memory.
Fair enough. That's good. That's really good. You know, to learn from a young age is important. I think, you know, over 80% of cardiac arrests happen in the home. So, you know, I can't remember which country it is, whether it's Denmark, Sweden. It's a country like that, in that area. You watch, they're probably completely opposite sides, but around that way. And one of them has a 6% better survival rate of CPR because kids from a young age are taught and it's compulsory. And that's what it's down to. In the UK, it's not compulsory, but it is pushed a lot more, and it's more of a choice of the schools now. And a part of my trust, we do teach in schools. Like, I was at a college this week teaching 120 kids CPR and what to look out for. And that's good, because the more you can teach them, the more they can help the people, the family, friends of the family and whatnot. And you've got a much better chance of survival of people in the home that go in and arrest. But yes, yeah, so the journal I'm with want me to start doing that. Now, I published that, and now I'm going to Dubai in July to a conference. This will be my fifth conference or sixth conference I've attended, but it's my second one that I'm going to attend in person. And that's basically where I go and speak about the papers that I've published. And they've got a very high interest in it because there are people there from these countries. So that's in Dubai. And I'm looking forward to that. It'll be an experience. And I've met some good people when I went to the last one in San Francisco in November. And I look forward to meeting more people, and the same people as well, that are going to come to this one in Dubai. And it's all about networking. LinkedIn. Is anyone here on LinkedIn? Are you on LinkedIn, Alex?
I am on LinkedIn.
I must add you on LinkedIn when we finish this. But yeah, so LinkedIn, if we're not already added. LinkedIn is, I tell you now, that was an absolute, I want to say godsend, but that was the platform where I was able to start connecting to people. I was on it for years, and I had no idea how it worked whatsoever. But once I started learning how it worked and how I could put myself out there, I get people coming to me now all the time, not all the time, but most of the time, asking, oh, can I do this? Can you do that? Would you like to do this? And LinkedIn's a big part of that. The journal, I don't know if they found me on LinkedIn, but the conferences, they did. That organization, their organizations found me on LinkedIn, found my papers that I put on LinkedIn, and then asked me to attend the conferences. So LinkedIn is a very good platform for people. Even if you're not qualified yet, you know, it's like a CV, but it's a professional one, and you can put so much on there. And we all have skills and we all have our strengths, and it's good to put that out there and to expand on them. And I think LinkedIn's a good platform to do that.
Absolutely, and just networking in general. I feel like the consensus is, like, we've had a lot of people ask and reach out to say, should I go to this conference? I'm only a first year paramedic student, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, no, it's fantastic. Start early, start chatting to people, start getting yourself out there, because realistically, at the end of the day, this job is about so much more than just, you know, being on road, and you've got the opportunity to make it into what you want. And I think that's kind of one of the biggest takeaways from today's conversation is, and having that LinkedIn or Twitter or whatever, but having some sort of professional platform to be able to not only express yourself, but start to get ideas. What are other people doing? And something that the podcast with Andy Bell that will be released the week prior or the fortnight prior to this one.
I'm looking forward to listening to.
So they talk about how Andy talked about how paramedics have such transferable skills, as we've already mentioned, but, you know, paramedics are finding themselves in positions that aren't even necessarily clinical, like CEOs of companies and entrepreneurs and everything. Research is, the world is literally our oyster, and I think just knowing that is fantastic, and having the guts, the courage just to start giving things a go and to start getting out of your comfort zone and talk to people, talk to the, you know, presenters at conferences. Just start networking.
Yeah, definitely. Don't be afraid to ask questions. You know, people are 99% of the time are more than happy to share what they can. But one thing I will say is, when it comes to the NQP or what you have to do if you're from Australia, I don't know, is there an NQP there as well?
Similar, yeah. There's a grad program in most different, like most states have a certain amount of time that you have to do a traineeship sort of thing.
Okay, how long does it last? Is it like a
Depends. I think from memory, they all differ in some way, shape, or form.
different states, different, yeah.
Yeah.
Same with America. So when it comes down to things like that, it's good to do that as well. If you feel that that's where you want to go, or if you feel, you know what, I'd like a bit more experience before I explore more, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all. It's good. Either way, you got to do what's right for you. But the main takeaway from that is make sure you're safe. Make sure you maintain what skills you can if you're not utilizing many skills. Like me, I still work at events as a paramedic to get patient contact. And with that, there are skills I haven't used in a while. And that's my responsibility to try and maintain my knowledge about those skills. But I also make sure that if there's certain skills that I need to carry out, because I work with doctors, pitch side teams in football, I always make sure they're aware. And I also make sure that if there's something that I need to do, that they will be there and I'll have that backup and support to remain safe the best I can. And it's also important that wherever you go, whatever you decide to do, that you get the right support. You know, make sure the person that you're with that's helping you, your mentor, your manager, your supervisor, your team leader, your crewmate, your colleague, make sure that they support you the best they can as you can support them as well. Because at the end of the day, especially if you're new, we need that support, especially the transition from school, college, uni, wherever you're from, to getting out there, whatever you're doing. And I've been quite fortunate in some aspects. If it wasn't for what happened before, I would never have been pushed to go further in a different direction. But I wish I'd just gone with what I felt at the time and just done that anyway. And if I did, but then again, I don't think I would be where I am now with the mindset I have if that didn't happen. So even the things that were negative, they still form a very strong part of the core being of what I'm trying to do. For example, sepsis, you know, we're in the trust that I'm in, sepsis is not talked about very much, but sepsis is a very big thing. And I think the education on sepsis needs to be put out a lot more. And that's why I help out the UK Sepsis Trust and try and get more universities to, from a student point of view, to try and get them to get sepsis talks and get people from the Sepsis Trust to come out or go through Zoom or Teams to give them like an hour, just an hour to give them a better understanding of what sepsis is and how it works and what we can do in the position that we're in. And just spread that education. And I think that's very beneficial. Because if you can understand something at a certain level, then you can definitely tackle it in the best possible way. So it's very important to do that. But
Absolutely.
yeah, make sure you get that support. Very important. Very important.
That's fantastic. And I think it's a great way to kind of start wrapping up today's episode, because I think, like you said, you've got to think about what your needs are, what your wants are, what you want your career to look like, and to sort of give things a go and just have the courage to do so. If there was anything to finalize on, or if you wanted there's one thing you want students, or grads, or people who've potentially been in the career for quite a while to know from your experience, what would it be?
To not be confined or constricted to what everyone else says that you need or have to do, to believe that if you there is something else or more that you feel you can do, to do it in the right way, the safest way, and the best possible way, to expand on your learning and education, and to explore the different opportunities that are out there, and to not be afraid to take steps now, even while you're a student or before you become a student, to get closer to those steps. That's what I would say. And to maintain your education and be safe.
That's fantastic. And if our listeners want to get to know more about you, your research articles, just keep in touch with you, ask him questions. Where can they find you?
Oh, LinkedIn. LinkedIn. Carl Dowling, LinkedIn. I'm wearing a green jumper and I'm teaching, and there's someone's head that's right next to me. So a bit blurred out. It was a good picture though. So if you need to find me, go on there, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions and help anyone that I can. I get people from different places that ask me questions and I try and help them. And I learn from them as they learn from me. And I think that's really important. We learn from each other at the end of the day.
Absolutely. I'll pop your link to your LinkedIn on our show notes so that everyone can just jump on straight away if they want to reach out. So I really appreciate you coming on today and talking about your journey. It's really enlightening, and I wish I had heard this when I was just starting out at university, because I think it would have changed a lot of things and the way I probably approached university and potentially the career. So I hope our listeners have gained something out of this, and as I have now. And, you know, I think it's okay even 2 years out of university to even think about these things as well. There's never a particular time. There's never a right time. You can just end now is the right time, anytime. So thank you so much for jumping on today, Carl. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for the listeners. I hope you all have a good day, and be safe.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.